All right.
Be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in the second and final matter today, Paradigm Oil Incorporated versus Pacific versus Vitamco Operating Incorporated.
May it please the court, Ms. Vance will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. What happened in this case illustrates why nearly every court in Texas and everywhere else has granted a defaulted defendant the right to participate in the damages hearing. Absent an adversarial process and given multiple opportunities to expand damages, we open the door to plaintiffs to simply name their own price.
They forfeited their adversarial process, at least to some extent, right? They failed to answer discovery, to show up for depositions, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't we take that into account?
Well, because the liability of the ending sanctions was the punishment for that, Chief. But once liability was established, the defendants were permitted to participate in damages to contest plaintiff's proof.
Do you want a bright-line rule that says it is never appropriate for a trial court to issue death penalty sanctions in the liability, in the damages phase of the case? A bright-line rule.
Justice Guzman, it would be difficult to imagine a circumstance where a complete blanket prohibition would be appropriate. In this case, certainly, that was not called for.
Well, one of the reasons there was difficulty, and maybe why you had three different results, it is asserted that they could not get from your clients the information that would enable them to put on an appropriate damages case. And in that circumstance, why is it not appropriate that death penalty sanctions be imposed?
Two reasons, Justice Guzman. First, the face of this record belies that assertion on Rotemco's part. It's never been their assertion that they could not make their case, only that they were delayed in doing so. And on the face of the record, you can see that they presented a damages model that they boast is over 10,000 pages long. We also can see that they had everything that they needed because the Court of Appeals has memorialized that. Rotemco produced more than 288 boxes of documents which were refused. Also, much of what they complained about not receiving was not in the control of Paradigm. The damages model covers front and back of Paradigm's interest. Paradigm did not have this information. Rotemco did have access to it because it was either in litigation or operating agreements with the folks who did have it.
Do you think then that if the evidence was that a defendant prevented the plaintiff from putting on the case on damages through their abuse of the discovery process, that this type of sanction, this death penalty sanction, would be appropriate in those circumstances? And I understand that you contend those are not the circumstances here.
I think what you're talking about is where we have the functional equivalent of spoliation, which Rotemco is now claiming before this court. But even in the event of spoliation, we don't put a blanket prohibition without the sanction being tailored to the prejudice. The offended party must show that the requested information was in control of the abuser and that it prejudiced the offended party. In other words, that it could not make its case and there was no other way to get this information. We know that that's not true in this case. And even in a case of spoliation, we require that the court make some findings and that it be shown that that was warranted in a properly tailored fashion, that it was calibrated to the actual prejudice. So truthfully, a rank spoliator has more protection than what was provided to Rotemco here.
If the party against whom the sanctions are entered can challenge the damages, is that a way potentially to allow liability to be retried? I mean, one side's arguing about the amount of damages. One of the potential responses is we didn't cause those damages. We may have caused some, but we didn't cause these. Well, then you back up into causation and liability issues potentially. Is that a backdoor way to retry liability? How do we guard against that?
I understand that that is the position of Rotemco and also adopted by the Court of Appeals, but I think that the Court of Appeals conflated what's required under Morgan, which is what's deemed in liability is that the defendant caused the event, in this case contract and perhaps fraud, which we contest. But after that, the plaintiff must still show by competent evidence that that event caused its damages. And there is certainly going to be some overlap in those inquiries. I think what happened here was the Court of Appeals put off limits any facts that were necessary to deem liability as no longer being relevant. That is not the case. There may be facts that need to be revisited to determine the causal link. But this is not retreading liability. I understand there can be some fuzziness there, but that is certainly not what Paradigm is asking. It's only asking that Rotemco be put to its burden to show that if it breached, it's deemed to have breached, deemed to have committed fraud, that those events caused the damages.
Well, how do you show the causal nexus between the events sued upon and the damages at the damages hearing if you can't get information on the wells and the output? You simply can't get it. How are you supposed to show that nexus?
Well, again, if that were the case, Justice Guzman, we might need to address that question. What we know here is that is not the case. In fact, the problem in this case is not what Rotemco did not get from Paradigm. In fact, Rotemco ignored information that it had in its damages model and simply substituted its own reasonableness elements. And secondly, truthfully, the problem is not what Rotemco didn't have. It's what it elected not to put into the record. And those are not documents that it complains that it did not receive from Paradigm. The punishment of deeming liability is certainly harsh, and I think we have to ask what beneficial purpose it serves to go beyond.
Is it harsh in this case? I mean, is there any real question that Paradigm did not pay what it owed under these agreements?
Absolutely.
There is.
Absolutely, Justice Hecht.
And what, I mean, not for the whole wells, but the 62 or however many of them are gone.
Well, of course, because a one-sided record has been allowed to be made here, it's very difficult for the court to see that. But we have included in our materials at tab 2, I believe, just an illustration. It's tab 3, pardon me. Just an illustration using Rotemco's own figures, their own inflated figures in our view, and applying only the bright line assignments that were withheld from the court or interpreted as not effective in our favor, you can see how the damages are stripped away. So, yes, there certainly is a question. And this is without adjustments for wells that should not be entitled or should not be subject to Rotemco's reversionary rights in any event, because they either were currently producing at the time of the agreement or were farmed out to other parties at the time of the agreement, so they were excluded by the terms of the contract.
So this is a case where the petitioners had what they thought and still think are good liability defenses, but just chose to put them at risk through the litigation process.
That's what we must conclude. But that does not mean that they leave their due process rights at the door. As I say, we don't see any beneficial purpose for precluding them from participation, and the result that unfolded here is a stark illustration of why we do not. Certainly, the purpose of discovery is to ensure that lawsuits are decided on the merits, not on what the facts reveal, not on what facts are concealed. So even in the complete absence of a defaulted defendant, we would not allow a plaintiff to come in and not put contracts into evidence, but just allow someone to describe what it would like them to mean.
But shouldn't we treat sanctions default defendants differently from a no-answer default defendant? Because in many ways, they charted the course of the litigation through their own actions.
No, Justice Guzman, and here's why. The default, the liability default, puts the defaulted defendant in the position of a no-answer defaulted defendant. All that happens is that we move quickly to the damages phase, and the plaintiff gets to win on liability. That's true as reflected in the cases that we've put before the court, where this is treated in either instance, whether it's a sanctions defaulted defendant or a no-answer defendant.
But there is no accident or mistake here that caused the default. Rather, there is intentional conduct. Maybe even a strategy, if you will. Isn't that different, and shouldn't that dictate perhaps a different standard for the appropriateness of death penalty sanctions in this case?
I don't believe so, Justice Guzman, for this reason. Certainly, we could argue that it may be more morally culpable conduct, the deliberate discovery abuser of a defendant who just does not answer. But who do we really want to levy the punishment for that? Do we want that to be the judge through a monetary fine that's appropriately calibrated to the actual behavior and prejudice? Or do we want that to be plaintiff's expert who's just simply allowed to name their own price, and particularly over multiple trials? I think that points up one of the problems that we face here, that because this was remanded several times, and because a one-sided record was allowed to be created, that meaningful legal sufficiency review is almost impossible. We have provided for the court, just to give a flavor of that, at tab one, some controverting evidence on just the key element of Rotampco's damages model, that is the operating expenses that they plugged in. That's the heart of their entire damages model. In any other circumstance, the court would be required under City of Keller to weigh all of the evidence. But here we only have one side of the story.
There are obviously a number of ways we could decide this case. What would be your reaction to a rule that says where the party has refused to produce documents, refused to produce witnesses for depots, didn't show up for hearings or discovery motions, and the trial court found egregious and flagrant pattern of discovery abuse in the case, hence death penalty for liability, that as to the damages phase, the most that party who abused the process can do is question the amount, not the causation or other liability issues of damages. That's what it looks like you're raising in tab one, amounts.
It is the amounts, but it also must be related to legally recoverable damages. There certainly is an element of causation, and that's what Morgan versus CompuGraphic stands for. I think the court has spoken to that, and it's easy to see here in a contract setting we have a breach, but did that actually cause Rotampco any harm? And that's what it must show.
Why must it be related to legally recoverable damages when your client forfeited the right to participate in the process all along until we might get a big number on damages?
Well, because we have a public policy that says we are going to harshly punish an offender of the process. However, after liability is established and we move to the damages phase, we also have a public policy that kicks in against allowing plaintiff windfalls far beyond legally recoverable damages. So constitutional safeguards have to kick in for the defendant, because up until that time, he hasn't been harmed, but he's exposed, of course, to great harm.
Has there been a case in the United States Supreme Court in this context that says the due process clause forbids this kind of sanction without the ability to cross-examine witnesses or not?
There is a case that is often cited for that proposition, Chief which is the Pope case. However, we have not cited it to the court because it is not clear. It's a very old case, so I would call the court's attention to it. However, every other jurisdiction that we have illustrated to the court to address this question has decided it on our position, with the exceptions that we have these Court of Appeals opinions that are at odds with the other intermediate courts in the state. I would just briefly go back to the causation that, absent an adversarial process, what's been allowed to happen here was that Botamco was allowed to fill in gaps in causation and also to conceal breaks in causation.
Let me interrupt you just to make sure I understand what you're asking the court to do. Is it obviously to reverse the judgment, but is it to render judgment, or are you seeking, because according to this chart, there's some damages you say that there's no evidence whatsoever, or is it to remand for a new trial in which you are able to contest damages?
I see my time is winding up, my wrestling. We believe this is not a case that the court can render on. We wish it were so. However, the evidence is certainly very complicated, and it needs to be tested through an adversarial proceeding. However, we do hope that the court will provide some guidance to the trial court about what legal conclusions and theories cannot be glossed over as deemed, and what the scope of the agreements is that the trial court must have before it and must interpret as a matter of law.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Drought will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. I've been involved in this case since 1999 when it first started off. The sanction that is under review today is the sanction that was imposed in Paradigm 1 back in 2004 in an opinion that was written by Justice Paul Green. Judges Payden, Boone, Gabriel, and Peoples all heard evidence of the discovery abuse of Paradigm in this case, and they made a finding that the damages, that the discovery abuse directly related to our ability to prove damages. What they're asking for you to do today is to overturn this decision that was made in 2004. And the thing is, this case before us today is Paradigm 3. When Justice Simmons at the Fourth Court wrote her opinion, she starts off with the opinion by saying, this case returns to us on a question of damages. Sanctions was not mentioned in that case. There are a lot of references to about this case conflicts with a lot of other cases relating to sanctions. We don't believe that they do anyhow, but as a matter of common sense, this case can't conflict with other cases involving sanctions because this case did not involve sanctions. It involved damages. And regarding the damages,
how does the law of the case doctrine impact your assertion that they have waived or not preserved the argument here on the liability aspect of this question?
Well, I think the law of the case does bar their presentation of this case today. Exceptional error or clearly erroneous exception to the law of the case doctrine, that they could have brought that up at any stage of this proceeding. Now, we went through 7 years of litigation without this sanction being brought up through Paradigm 2 and through Finley and through the appeal in Paradigm 3. They didn't bring it up, but
They had a final judgment, if you will, including on the damages, in what case, to go back.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
The Paradigm 3 is the time when they had that final judgment.
Yes, Paradigm 3 is when they had the final judgment on damages. But If they thought that this sanction was such an egregious thing or such a, you know, violation of due process, an exception to the law of the case doctrine is clearly erroneous, and they never brought it up at any of these other proceedings. So we go through 7 years of litigation, and they don't bring it up until we get to the Supreme Court. You know, I think they've got monumental preservation of error problems here, and that this court should not consider the sanctions at this time. They did raise this issue of sanctions when they appealed to this court in Paradigm 1, the petition for review, which this court denied. And again, Finley raised it, or actually Finley didn't raise it. But let me just tell you a little bit about the background of the case. The company, Retomco, is a family-owned company by Steve and Marty Ghost, husband and wife. This case started off when Steve was 70. He's now 82. He's been in the oil and gas business his entire life. He's had some good times and he's had some bad times, like many of the oil and gas people do. And in the early 80s, he was doing quite well. He had a line of credit with the Security Pacific National Bank for $70 million. He had secured it with these 572 leases. But by 1984, he got worried about whether or not he was going to be able to make this, pay back this loan. And he made a deal with the bank that said, I will give you back these leases, but I want to retain overriding royalty rights and back-end working rights on new wells that would be leased. You can have the old wells, but if new wells are drilled, I want these rights. This agreement, this 84 agreement, was extremely complex. And one of the handouts that I've given you today are the defined terms in that agreement. There are more than 83 different defined terms. And in some of those defined terms, there are more defined terms. So it's an extremely difficult agreement.
It is very complex, but there's one aspect of it, and this isn't related directly to the default, but to the damages and the calculation of damages. Was there in that agreement an agreement that Paradigm would pay for at least what petitioner says is 510 leases in which they had no involvement whatsoever?
The way the agreement was written, there's a section 8.10 that says that if the bank, or the original bank, Security Pacific, if it wanted to release its liability for future damages, it would have to make the assignments specifically subject to Retomco's rights under the agreement. That was not done in the assignments of the 510 leases to Clements, and it was never done in the assignment to Paradigm, or from Paradigm's assignments later on to Crimson and others. And the agreement specifically says that if you don't make it subject to Steve's rights, you remain liable. And they did that because this was a complicated agreement. How would anybody know that my client was entitled to rights unless they actually made it subject to, and they didn't do it? And so what happened, Clements got some of the leases, but Paradigm admitted that it was liable with the bank, and that was deemed admitted. And so all of the misconduct of the bank, all of the liability of the bank attached to Paradigm also. And so that's how we're liable or entitled to get damages for some of those leases that went to Clements. Now, I think it's important for you to understand that Richard Carone, who is the principal behind all of these affiliated companies, he was involved in this case since 1984, since the time of this 1984 agreement. He first was a consultant with the bank. He then became an operator. He then became an owner of these leases. He knew from the very beginning the importance of this agreement, and I believe that this evidence here shows that they felt the bank and Carone felt like Steve really wasn't entitled to these rights. After all, they claimed that he was in default, and they just ignored it. They decided, we're going to ignore it. Mr. Ghost doesn't have any money. He can't pay. He can't sue us. The evidence reflects that he wrote letters and said, we would please send us some money. He says, I know it's a little thing to you, but, you know, we're on hard times. They knew he didn't have the resources at that time to present this case. And
this was after the agreements had been made.
Yes, after the agreements were made.
How is any of that fraud?
Well, what's fraud is that they forged endorsements on checks. They grossly overcharged for operating expenses. They charged.
But aren't overcharges just breach of the agreement?
No. It could be, but in this case, it's also fraud. I mean, it's an independent, and the court found that there was an independent fraud, and, you know, they admitted fraud. I mean,
well, they admitted the allegations of the petition, which allege failure to pay and deducting improper expenses and overstating expenses and lots of things. But that all sounds like a breach of contract to me.
No, Your Honor, I think that if you look at the record in this case and everything that they did and the way that they concealed the rights of Steve Ghost, they deliberately went up on a course to sabotage his rights. They claimed that he was incompetent, even though we have a letter from Dolph Briscoe, who owned the Briscoe lease, that said that Rotomco is a really great operation. They did a lot of things that amounted to fraud.
Well, let me ask you just a little more about that. If a person decides he doesn't want to honor the contract, but he doesn't want you to know that because he doesn't want you to find out about it and sue him, is that fraud or just breach of contract?
I think in this case, under this record, it's fraud.
And if it's not, what else is there that shows fraud other than just people not wanting to honor their commitments?
Well, like I said before, we have about 10 different allegations of fraud, and I think that you can have an independent cause of action for fraud even arising out of a contractual situation, and I think that the proof here shows that, and I think the deemed admissions prove that. But
did they cover the 62 wells, or did you plead that you had incurred damages as a result of the 510 wells? So what were they on notice of when they got your lawsuit, 62 wells or 510?
They were under notice.
And I guess I should say, let me rephrase that. What did you plead that would put them on notice?
We pled that they assumed all the responsibilities of all of the obligations of PNB.
62 wells.
500 wells. All of the obligations, and they were considered to be jointly and severally liable, and they admitted that they were in a conspiracy with them. Now, our damage proof, though, did not relate to all 500 wells. It related to one big lease, the Briscoe lease, and about nine other wells that were over in the Giddings Field. And so it's not like we're claiming damages for all 572. The record is clear on that.
You said a couple times that they admitted and that there were deemed admissions. Are you talking about aside and apart from the deemed admission of the pleading?
No.
Of your pleadings, or are you talking about separate discovery admissions that were deemed admitted?
No, I'm talking about the deemed admissions in the pleadings.
Okay, so but you didn't send them a request for admission saying, admit you conspired to defraud my client?
We sent requests for admissions, but they were never answered. And I don't think I asked liability questions in a specific nature, but they refused all discovery. I mean, they didn't answer
okay,
anything.
Okay, so the deemed admissions you're talking about go to simply admissions of the pleadings.
Right. And I want to point out that there are two pleadings that we're concerned with here. Not only the first one was our fifth amended pleading that had our causes of action against Paradigm. We had a ninth amended pleading against Finley. We And in Finley, we alleged spoliation, and they didn't answer that one either. So they have been deemed to have admitted that they destroyed documents. And that's a point that that counsel on the other side has tried to distinguish the In Re Dynamic Healthcare case by saying that that was a spoliation case, and we don't have a spoliation case, but we do have a spoliation case here.
Mr. Dodd, let me ask you to explain to me why there should be a difference in the law depending on which procedural environment you find yourself in. On the one hand, in a no-answer default judgment case, a defendant can intentionally refuse to answer a lawsuit that is properly served and yet is entitled to contest damages in a hearing after that default. In the latter instance, a post-answer default judgment, a defendant can intentionally refuse to answer discovery and show up for hearings, and yet is disallowed the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses on damages. Why should the law have different outcomes based on that procedural environment?
For this reason, there are some cases where liability cannot be contested. Where the facts are such, you really can't do it. But damages are contested. So you could have a situation where a defendant purposely says, okay, we can't contest liability, but what we're going to do, we're going to stonewall everybody on damages. We're not going to show up for depositions. We're not going to give you any documents. We're not going to tell you anything about damages. Yet we get to depose your clients. We get to get documents from you. And then they show up at trial, and we have to try to prove damages when we don't have the benefit of it. So the harm is greater to us than to them. In this case, they purposely disregarded discovery. They came into this case with 12 different law firms, with 27 different lawyers working on it, and they never presented a defense on damages or liability. And why do you suppose that that was the case? Well, they don't really have a defense.
Well,
and they don't have a defense, and their actions raise the presumption that their defense lacked merit.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. To satisfy due process and death penalty sanctions, then if you don't produce discovery, the presumption is that your asserted claim or defense lacks merit, and therefore due process is satisfied by that presumption. What is the presumption here in this context that satisfies due process and justifies precluding Paradigm from presenting anything on the liability phase?
Well, the presumption is that if you do not play by the rules, if you do not produce any kind of evidence and try to show up at trial and ambush us, the presumption raises. I mean, as Justice Heck in Trans-American case, I mean, that's good law. It's worked for 20 years, and it ought to work here. If they don't do these things, the presumption is that their defense lacks merit, and that's exactly what happened here. And if they had a defense, why wouldn't they have brought it up? Why do we have to go through this? And I wanted to show you, I mean, another exhibit is the map Giddings Field that shows the complexity of what we had to deal with. We had to hire a landman that spent 550 hours trying to figure this thing out. We spent over $100,000. We had to hire the first landman for $40,000 that couldn't figure it out, and we had to get another one. This is in the record. The damages were very complex, and what counsel said was not correct about about Paradigm not being able to furnish some of this evidence. Paradigm, even to this day, or its affiliated companies, has an interest in these wells that have been transferred to their California corporations, but they have an interest. They had the ability to tell us which wells they had an interest in, and if you look at the defined terms in the 84 agreement, there's like draining wells, there's all kinds of complicated things that they could have told us, and we wouldn't have had to spend 8 years $100,000 on landmen trying to figure it out if they would have complied with the discovery.
But Paradigm's position is you can get that if you prove it. They're just saying you shouldn't get it automatically, right?
Well,
I'm not saying
we
you can't get those damages.
We did prove it. I mean, that's...
But
not in an adversarial proceeding.
No, we didn't. They were entitled to an adversarial hearing because of their egregious discovery abuse. I mean,
let me ask you about this. How does the court system guard against, and should it, in the case of damages that are clearly not legally recoverable in Texas? Let's say your default judgment was in a different case on negligent infliction of emotional distress, which does not exist as a cause of action in Texas.
Right.
Or let's say you sought damages and were able to obtain them because you mistakenly thought you could get $1 million a well when really it was only, let's say, $500,000, just a mistake. But there's no opportunity for a cross or putting that through the adversarial process to make those corrections. Should the courts say, that's okay, you can get both of those types of damages without and not have the adversarial process as a check in a post-answer default judgment case?
No, and what happened here is even in a situation where they're not allowed to put on evidence of their damages, you have the trial court is the gatekeeper or to look at the type of evidence and decide whether or not it's appropriate. And you have the Court of Appeals, and they did perform their role, as we know in Paradigm 2. They sent the case back for us to prove additional damages. So there is a safeguard. I mean, there's not a way that we're going to be able to ask for the moon and be able to get it.
Well, except that the trial judge and the Court of Appeals justices, as sharp as they may be, are still making decisions based on the record, which they don't know. They only know what's put into the record. If you don't allow anything from the other side, then the record's going to say only what one side says.
Right? No. In this case, and that's the last handout that I've given you, the one that shows the 20 or so trial motions that they filed, they raised this issue. They raised every single document that they're complaining about. They raised all these assignments, everything over and over and over again. And the judge ruled on those on the merits. They didn't just say, no, we're not going to hear you because of sanctions. The trial court knew about it. The Court of Appeals knew about it. The Court of Appeals had those documents. So it's not like we pulled the wool over the eyes of the trial judge or the Court of Appeals. I see that I'm out of time here. I appreciate your attention on this today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grout. The court will hear rebuttal.
I'd like to first respond to the court's question as to how Paradigm can be saddled with an obligation of the 510 leases when it only bought 62. And if we just look at that for just a moment, we can see exactly the problem in this case when a defendant is not allowed to test the veracity of the plaintiff's damages proof. At every turn, Rotamco has had to make a very convoluted and tortured construct out of these agreements, in most cases without putting them before the trial court. It's absolutely incorrect what my opposing counsel says, that the trial court ruled on the merits or the legal effect of those documents or that the Court of Appeals did. In fact, they both said, we can't look at those. You're sanctioned. They are in the record by virtue of our very fervent, if ultimately futile, attempt to try to get a fair process. But let's look at the hoops that they have to go through to saddle Paradigm with those 510 leases that were sold to a third party 8 years before Paradigm even showed up on the scene. First, that PNV did not assign them according to the terms because it didn't make them subject to and explain Rotamco's rights. That is certainly untrue. It was assigned according to Rotamco's rights, and also there is a recorded document that recites nearly verbatim Rotamco's rights in the 1984 agreement. It's at Plaintiff's Exhibit 3. There was a document of record that showed those rights. Secondly, 8 years later, Paradigm purchases 62 of the leases. The gap filler there is that Paradigm was alleged to have assumed all of PNB's obligations, but that is not what was alleged. It was alleged that Paradigm took its interest, subject to the 1984 agreement, but only under the terms of the 1993 assignment. So it's limited to those 62 leases. And the fallback is, well, we've alleged these joint liability theories and conspiracy, but the problem with that is that on the Giddings leases, it's a contract claim only. It's a contract claim only because Giddings, Paradigm never operated the Giddings leases, any of them. It didn't own most of them. So it didn't have any opportunity to conspire with anyone. To what end, if it did, it couldn't have affected those leases that were already in the hands of a third party. It couldn't have kept Rotamco's interest from vesting because it wasn't operating the wells. And certainly in a contract theory, we can't just throw a net over everyone and say, because you were all in cahoots, we can infect you with this eight-year-old obligation. So because we have some allegations of fraud over here, there's not just sort of fraud in the air that we can, by virtue of just a bare allegation of fraud, bootstrap contractual liability onto Paradigm. Briefly, the risk of...
Ms. Vance, let me ask you in that regard. In response to the Chief's question, Mr. Drought says that the difference between a no-answer default and a post-answer default is, in the latter case, the party knows what's going on. They've answered. They're just... They've answered the lawsuit. They're in the case. But in that second scenario, they don't respond to discovery. They don't respond to, I assume there are trial court orders compelling certain actions, don't respond to those. They don't do anything, and they know the potential you're talking about and the allegations and the claims and the contract interpretations are going on and just don't act. So that's why there shouldn't be the opportunity to contest adversarially damages in the second case, because you know what's going on, and elect in a flagrant, as the trial judge held, a flagrant abuse of the discovery process not to participate. Why shouldn't we just take his position on that?
Well, because we don't really know if a defendant does not answer that it didn't thumb its nose at the court. It may be the exact same circumstance. It just thumbed its nose at the court earlier rather than later. And once we have deemed liability, that is the punishment. And anything beyond that should be a money sanction that is properly calibrated to both punish and deter. But we don't want plaintiffs just to win the lottery sanctions as a punishment, especially here, where Mr. Drought complains about this oh-so-long process. But Paradigm, during this all very long litigation process, won three appeals because Rotamco, despite shooting at a city duck, could not persistently prove its damages.
Let me ask you another question that gets into the logistics of the case. All the discovery that was not answered during the lawsuit, probably a good part of that relates to damages. Of course, that's all precluded because there was a failure to participate. If we say, but yes, the damages process now is going to be adversarial, all of that discovery that is precluded because of sanctions, now it's going to come back up as a question. Do you now get to get that discovery and submit it in the damages process when you didn't during the litigation? Does that have to be reopened under your theory?
It doesn't have to be reopened, Justice Wainwright. I think, as I said earlier, there are certain things that are going to overlap to be able to establish damages. But I see that my time is winding up here, but if I may respond.
Please.
Let's just look at 96% of the wells that they now claim damages for were not in existence at the time that Rotamco sold its interest to Crimson in the Briscoe lease. Paradigm could not have had that information. It is not relevant to their legally recoverable damages. They don't own those wells. We cannot just continue to let Rotamco ring up the cash register because it continues to get opportunities to expand its damages. There may be wells being drilled on the Briscoe lease as we speak, but Rotamco does not own those.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vance. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for the day. I want to just take a brief second to congratulate the counsel in both cases. Not only were their briefs well-written, organized, and provided great assistance to the court in grappling with these issues, but as you have seen, their oral advocacy is superb and will aid in the court's evaluation of how these cases should come out. The one good thing I think that we've done at the court since March 2007 is to put all of these arguments online. So if you are interested in becoming an appellate advocate, you need only go to the website and take a look and watch the arguments, and you'll see some excellent ones like you saw today, but you'll also see some that teach you the other way to argue the case, which is not necessarily a good thing. So I encourage you to do that, and you can read the briefs and then read the opinions as well. The second thing I wanted to say is I was a law student here, as you heard, and I was a member of the Thurgood Marshall Legal Society way back when, in 1985 through 1988. We wouldn't be here today but for the invitation from the Thurgood Marshall Legal Society to come and hear arguments on this campus, and so I want to thank them for inviting us here. And to the faculty and the staff of this great law school, you give us a tremendous honor by welcoming us in the fashion that you've done, and we appreciate that very much. That concludes the arguments for today and our another great session here at the University of Texas School of Law. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.